overrun by companies that make disruptive innovations, big changes that allow them to produce a cheaper, poorer quality product for a much larger market. IBM made sustaining innovations in its mainframe computers, a big expensive product marketed to big businesses. Apple, selling a personal computer that ordinary people could afford, made a disruptive innovation. After 9/11, disruptive innovation, a theory that rested on weak empirical evidence, became gospel, a system of belief, a way of reckoning with uncertainty in an age of rapid change, an age of terror. Terrorism was itself a kind of disruptive innovation, cheaper and faster than conventional war. The gospel of disruptive innovation applauded recklessness and heedlessness. Mark Zuckerberg founded Facebook in 2004 when he was not yet 20, partly with funding from Thiel. "Unless you're breaking stuff, you aren't moving fast enough," he said, embracing the heedlessness of disruptive innovation. "Don't be evil," was Google's motto, though how to steer clear of iniquity appears to have been left to market forces. Companies and whole industries that failed were meant to fail. Disruptive innovation aligned itself with social Darwinism. Above all, the government was to play no role in restraining corporate behavior. That had been a solution for the industrial age, and this was an age of knowledge. One of the first casualties of disruptive innovation, from the vantage of American democracy, was the paper newspaper, which had supplied the electorate with information about politics in the world and a sense of political community since before the American Revolution. "Printers are educated in the belief that when men differ in opinion," Benjamin Franklin had once written, "both sides ought equally to have the advantage of being heard by the public, and that when truth and error have fair play, the former is always an overmatch for the latter." There had been great newspapers, and there had been lousy newspapers, but the Republic had never known a time without newspapers, and it was by no means clear that the Republic could survive without them, or at least without the freedom of the press on which they were established, the floor on which civil society stands. Nevertheless, neither that history nor that freedom, nor any manner of editorial judgment whatsoever, informed decisions made by the disruptive innovators who declared the newspaper dead. The deregulation of the communications industry had allowed for massive mergers. General Electric bought RCA and NBC. Time merged with Warner and then with AOL. Newspapers housed within this giant corporation became less accountable to their readers than to stockholders. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and National Public Radio were among a handful of exceptions. Fast-growing dot-coms had been a chief source of newspaper advertising revenue. During the dot-com bust, those companies either slashed their advertising budgets or eliminated them. They also turned to advertising online instead. Readers found that they could get their news without paying for it from news aggregators that took reported stories from the newspapers and reprinted them. Papers began laying off a generation of experienced editors and reporters, then whole bureaus, and then the papers themselves began closing their doors. "The Internet is the most democratizing innovation we've ever seen," Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean's campaign manager said in 2004, "more so even than the printing press." At the time, many journalists agreed. Tom Brokaw talked about the democratization of news, and conservative journalists in particular celebrated the shattering of the power of elites to determine what is news and what is not. Compared to newspapers and broadcast television news, the information available on the Internet was breathtakingly vast and thrilling. It was also uneven, unreliable, and except in certain cases, unrestrained by standards of reporting, editing, and fact-checking. The Internet didn't leave seekers of news free. It left them brutally constrained. It accelerated the transmission of information, but the selection of that information, the engine that searched for it, was controlled by the biggest unregulated monopoly in the history of American business. Google went public in 2004. By 2016, it controlled nearly 90% of the market. The Internet transformed the public sphere, blurring the line between what political scientists had for decades called the political elite and the mass public. But it did not democratize politics. Instead, the Internet hastened political changes that were already underway. A model of citizenship that involved debate and deliberation had long since yielded to a model of citizenship that involved consumption and persuasion. With the Internet, that model yielded to a model of citizenship driven by the hyper-individualism of blogging, posting, and tweeting, artifacts of a new culture of narcissism, and by the hyper-aggregation of the analysis of data, tools of a new authoritarianism. Data collected online allowed websites and search engines and eventually social media companies to profile users and acting as companies selling products rather than as news organizations concerned with the public interest, to feed them only the news and views with which they agreed, and then to radicalize them. Public opinion polling by telephone was replaced by the collection and analysis of data. Social media, beginning with Facebook, moving fast and breaking things, exacerbated the political isolation of ordinary Americans while strengthening polarization on both the left and the right, automating identity politics and contributing at the same time to a distant, vague, and impotent model of political engagement. In a wireless world, the mystic cords of memory, the ties to timeless truths that held the nation together, faded to ethereal invisibility. "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there," Bush said when he addressed Congress and a shaken nation on September 20th, 2001. "It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." Bush pledged to destroy not only the perpetrators of the attacks on 9/11, but terrorism itself. This was not merely the saber-rattling of a moment. By 2006, the stated objective of the National Security Strategy of the United States was to end tyranny. Like a war on poverty, a war on crime, and a war on drugs, a war on terror could imagine no end. Terrorism respected no borders and recognized no laws. Fighting it risked doing the same. In 1980, 23-year-old Osama bin Laden had joined a resistance movement against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, supplying funds and building a network of supporters. In 1988, when the Mujahideen triumphed and the Soviet Union agreed to withdraw from Afghanistan, bin Laden formed Al-Qaeda as a base for future jihads or holy wars. Bin Laden was not a cleric and did not in any way speak for the religion of Islam, but he did describe his movement in religious terms as a form of political incitement. At a time of economic decline, political unrest, and violent sectarianism throughout the Arab world, he called for a jihad against Americans, whom he described as a godless, materialist people. Bin Laden argued that Americans had defiled the Islamic world and undermined the Muslim faith by causing wars between Muslims in Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. "It is saddening to tell you that you are the worst civilization witnessed by the history of mankind," he wrote in a letter to America. In 1990, he urged the Saudi monarchy to support a jihad to retake Kuwait after the Americans ousted Saddam Hussein. Instead, the Saudis welcomed U.S. forces into Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden denounced the American occupation and recruited and trained forces for terrorist acts that included suicide bombings. The CIA formed a special unit to work against Al-Qaeda and bin Laden in 1996, by which time bin Laden had declared war on the United States and found refuge with the Taliban, radical Islamic fundamentalists who had taken over Afghanistan and remade it as a religious state. In 1998, bin Laden called for a fatwa against all Americans, describing the murder of Americans as the individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country, in the name of a world Islamic front. After 9/11, the Bush administration demanded that the Taliban hand over bin Laden. The Taliban refused. On October 7, 2001, the United States began a war in Afghanistan. The immediate end of the war, aided by coalition partners, was to defeat Al-Qaeda. Its more distant aim was to replace the Taliban with a democratically elected pro-Western government. It became the longest war in American history. The Bush administration conceived of the war on terror as an opportunity to strike against hostile regimes all over the world on the grounds that they harbored and funded terrorists. Between 1998 and 2011, military spending nearly doubled, reaching more than $700 billion a year, more in adjusted dollars than at any time since the Allies were fighting the Axis. In his 2002 State of the Union address, Bush described Iraq and Iran and North Korea as another axis. "States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world," he said. "By seeking weapons of mass destruction, these regimes pose a grave and growing danger. They could provide these arms to terrorists, giving them the means to match their hatred." For all his fierce rhetoric, Bush took great pains and care not to denounce Islam itself, steering clear of inciting still more hatred. "All Americans must recognize that the face of terror is not the true face of Islam," he said later that year. "Islam is a faith that brings comfort to a billion people around the world. It is a faith that has made brothers and sisters of every race. It is a faith based upon love, not hate." The Bush administration soon opened a second front in the war on terror. In 2003, another U.S.-led coalition invaded Iraq with the aim of eradicating both Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. The architects of this war were neoconservatives who regretted what they saw as George H.W. Bush's premature withdrawal from the Middle East, his failing to occupy Iraq and topple Hussein after pushing him out of Kuwait. With few exceptions, Democrats and Republicans alike supported the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But support for the Iraq war was from the start more limited and dwindled further after it became clear that Hussein, in fact, had no weapons of mass destruction. In 2003, the United States invaded a country that did not threaten us, did not attack us, and did not want war with us, to disarm it of weapons we have since discovered it did not have, wrote Pat Buchanan, placing the blame for the war on the neocons' hijacking of the conservative movement, whose influence he greatly regretted. He complained, "Neoconservatives captured the foundations, think tanks, and opinion journals of the right, and were allowed to redefine conservatism." The War on Terror differed from every earlier American war. It was led from Washington by men and women who had never served in the military, and it was fought in the Middle East by an all-volunteer force whose sacrifices American civilians did not share or know or even, finally, consider. In both Afghanistan and Iraq, the United States' regime-building efforts failed. Vietnam had been a bad war and a distant war, and its sacrifices had been unevenly borne, but they had been shared and protested. Far distant from the United States and parts of the world that few Americans had ever visited, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were fought by a tiny slice of the American population. Between 2001 and 2011, less than 0.5% of Americans saw active duty. Hardly any members of Congress had ever seen combat or had family members who had. "God help this country when someone sits in this chair who doesn't know the military as well as I do," Eisenhower once said. George H.W. Bush was the last president of the United States to have served in the U.S. military, to fear and loathe war because of knowing war. His successors lacked that knowledge. During the Vietnam War, George W. Bush had avoided combat by serving in the Texas Air National Guard. Bill Clinton and Donald Trump had dodged the draft. Obama came of age after that war was over. None of these men had sons or daughters who served in the military. The War on Terror had its dissenters. Among them were those who fought it. A 2011 Pew study reported that half of the veterans of Afghanistan and Iraq thought the war in Afghanistan wasn't worth fighting. Nearly 60% thought that the war in Iraq wasn't worth it, and a third thought neither war was worth what it cost. One of the War on Terror's severest critics was Andrew J. Basevich, a West Point graduate and career Army officer who, after fighting in Vietnam in 1970 and 1971, had risen to the rank of colonel and become a history professor. Basevich's only son was killed in Iraq. A Catholic and a conservative, Basevich argued that while few Americans served in the military, Americans and the American government had fallen prey to militarism, manifesting itself in a romantic view of soldiers, a tendency to see military power as the truest measure of national greatness, and outsized expectations regarding the efficacy of force. Somehow, Basevich wrote, Americans accepted that it was the fate of the United States to engage in permanent war without dissent. The citizens of the United States have essentially forfeited any capacity to ask first-order questions about the fundamentals of national security policy. By no means had the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq gone unquestioned, but one reason there had been relatively little debate had to do not only with a widening gap between the civilian and the military populations, but also with the consequences of disruptive innovation. In many parts of the country, the daily paper, with its side-by-side op-ed essays, had vanished. Voters had been sorted into parties, the parties had been sorted ideologically, and a new political establishment, the conservative media, having labeled and derided the mainstream media as biased, abdicated dispassionate debate. Rigorous studies of newspapers had not, up to that point, been able to discern a partisan bias. Nevertheless, the conservative establishment insisted that such bias existed, warned their audiences away from non-conservative media outlets, and insulated their audience from the possibility of persuasion by non-conservative outlets by insisting that anything except the conservative media was the liberal media. This critique applied not only to the news, but to all manner of knowledge. "Science has been corrupted," Rush Limbaugh said on the radio in 2009. "We know the media has been corrupted for a long time. Academia has been corrupted. None of what they do is real. It's all lies." Limbaugh, who came of age during the Vietnam War but did not serve in the military, apparently due to assist, strenuously supported the War on Terror. Roger Ailes, who, like Limbaugh, had neither seen combat in Vietnam nor served in the military, Ailes suffered from hemophilia, strongly supported the U.S. military action in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And his network, Fox News, did more than report the wars, it promoted them. After 9/11, when Fox News anchors and reporters began wearing flag pins, some journalists, including CBS's Morley Safer, condemned the practice. Ailes brushed him off. I'm a little bit squishy on killing babies, but when it comes to flag pins, I'm pro-choice. When the United States invaded Iraq, Fox News adopted an on-air chyron, the War on Terror. John Moody, Fox's vice president for news, circulated morning memos with directives for the day's coverage. On June 3, 2003, he wrote, "The president is doing something that few of his predecessors dared undertake, putting the U.S. case for Mideast peace to an Arab summit. It's a distinctly skeptical crowd that Bush faces. His political courage and tactical cunning are worth noting in our reporting through the day." On March 23, 2004, following early reports that the 9/11 Commission was investigating the degree of negligence involved in the Bush administration leading up to the attacks, Moody wrote, "Do not turn this into Watergate. Remember the fleeting sense of national unity that emerged from this tragedy. Let's not desecrate that." Moody's editorial directives included prohibitions on certain words. On April 28, 2004, he wrote, "Let's refer to the U.S. Marines we see in the foreground as sharpshooters, not snipers, which carries a negative connotation." Walter Cronkite said of the memos after they were leaked, "I've never seen or heard any other network nor any other legitimate news organization doing that, newspaper or broadcast." The conservative media establishment broadcast from a bunker, garrisoned against dissenters. Those who listened to Rush Limbaugh, and who only years before had also gotten news from their local newspapers and from network television, were now far more likely to watch only Fox News, and if they read a newspaper, to read only the Wall Street Journal, which, like Fox, was owned as of 2007 by Rupert Murdoch. The conservative websites to which search engines directed listeners of Limbaugh, watchers of Fox News, and readers of the Wall Street Journal only reinforced this view. "It's a great way to have your cake and eat it, too," wrote Matt Labash of the Weekly Standard in 2003. "Criticize other people for not being objective. Be as subjective as you want. It's a great little racket. I'm glad we found it, actually." Other administrations, of course, had lied, as the Pentagon Papers had abundantly demonstrated. But in pursuing regime change in the Middle East, the Bush administration dismissed the advice of experts and took the radically postmodern view that all knowledge is relative, a matter of dueling political claims rather than of objective truth. That view had characterized not only its decision to go to war with Iraq, but also the campaign's argument against the recount in 2000 and Bush's withdrawal from the Kyoto Protocol, a climate change agreement, in 2001. In 2002, a senior Bush advisor told a reporter for the New York Times that journalists believe that solutions emerge from a judicious study of discernible reality, but that's not the way the world works anymore. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. The culture and structure of the Internet made it possible for citizens to live in their own realities, too. Jaundiced journalists began to found online political fact-checking sites like PolitiFact, which rated the statements of politicians on a truth-o-meter. "I'm no fan of dictionaries or reference books. They're elitist," the satirist Stephen Colbert said in 2005 when he coined truthiness while lampooning George W. Bush. "I don't trust books. They're all fact, no heart. And that's exactly what's pulling our country apart today." But eventually, liberals would respond to the conservative media by imitating them, two squirrels chasing each other down a tree. What did he know and when did he know it? Had been the pressing question of the Watergate investigation. What does anyone know anymore, and what is knowledge anyway? Became the question of the Bush era. The United States' position as the leader of a liberal world order based on the rule of law entered a period of crisis when, pursuing its war on terror, the country defied its founding principles and flouted the Geneva Conventions, international law, and human rights through the torture of suspected terrorists and their imprisonment without trial. On October 26, 2001, Bush signed the Patriot Act, granting the federal government new powers to conduct surveillance and collect intelligence to prevent and investigate terrorist acts. It passed both houses less than 2 months after the 9/11 attacks, in a frenzied climate in which legislators who dared to break ranks were labeled unpatriotic. Outside the Capitol, the ACLU and the Electronic Frontier Foundation were among the many vocal opponents of the act, citing violations of civil liberties, especially as established under the Fourth Amendment, and of civil rights, especially the due process provision of the 14th Amendment. John Ashcroft, Bush's attorney general, defended the Patriot Act, citing the war on drugs as a precedent for the war on terror. Most Americans expect that law enforcement tools used for decades to fight organized crime and drugs be available to protect lives and liberties from terrorists, Ashcroft said. In November 2001, Bush signed a military order concerning the detention, treatment, and trial of certain non-citizens in the war against terrorism. Suspected terrorists who were not citizens of the United States were to be detained at an appropriate location designated by the Secretary of Defense. If brought to trial, they were to be tried and sentenced by military commissions. The ordinary rules of military law would not apply, nor would the laws of war, nor the laws of the United States. The conduct of war will always challenge a nation founded on a commitment to justice. It will call back the nation's history, its earlier struggles, its triumphs and failures. There were shades during the War on Terror of the Alien and Sedition Acts passed in 1798 during the quasi-war with France, of the Espionage Act of the First World War, and of FDR's Japanese internment order during the Second World War. But with Bush's November 2001 military order, the War on Terror became itself, like another airplane, attacking the edifice of American law, down to its very footings, the ancient medieval foundations of trial by jury and the battle for truth. "You've got to be kidding me," Ashcroft said when he read a draft of the order. He'd expected the prosecution of people involved in the planning of the attacks on 9/11 to be handled criminally by his department, as had been done successfully with earlier terrorism cases, with due process. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of State Colin Powell only learned that Bush had signed the order when they saw it on television. In the final draft, the Department of Justice was left out of the prosecutions altogether. Suspected terrorists were to be imprisoned without charge, denied knowledge of the evidence against them, and if tried, sentenced by courts following no established rules. The order deemed the principles of law and the rules of evidence generally recognized in the trial of criminal cases in the United States district courts to be impractical. The means by which truth was to be established and justice secured, traditions established and redefined over centuries, were deemed inconvenient. Now, some people say, well, gee, that's a dramatic departure from traditional jurisprudence in the United States, Vice President Cheney said. But we think it guarantees that we'll have the kind of treatment of these individuals that we believe they deserve. The Bush administration's course of action with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and with the military tribunals, and with the Patriot Act, rested on an expansive theory of presidential power. The party in control of the White House tends to like presidential power, only to change its mind when it loses the White House. From Woodrow Wilson through FDR and Lyndon Johnson, Democrats had liked presidential power and had tried to extend it, while Republicans had tried to limit it. Beginning with the presidency of Richard Nixon, Democrats and Republicans had reversed their positions, Republicans extending presidential power with Nixon and Reagan. But the conservative effort to expand the powers of the presidency reached a new height in the George W. Bush administration, and power seized while the nation reeled from an unprecedented attack. Beginning in the fall of 2001, the U.S. military dropped flyers over Afghanistan, offering bounties of between $5,000 and $25,000 for the names of men with ties to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. "This is enough money to take care of your family, your village, your tribe for the rest of your life," one flyer read. The average annual income in Afghanistan at the time was less than $300. The flyers fell, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said, like snowflakes in December in Chicago. Unlike many in Bush's inner circle, Rumsfeld was a veteran. He served as a Navy pilot in the 1950s. As hundreds of men were rounded up abroad, the Bush administration considered where to put them. Taking over the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth, Kansas, and reopening Alcatraz, closed since 1963, were both considered but rejected because, from Kansas or California, suspected terrorists would be able to appeal to American courts and under U.S. state and federal law. Diego Garcia, an island in the Indian Ocean, was rejected because it happened to be a British territory and therefore subject to British law. In the end, the administration chose Guantanamo, a U.S. naval base on the southeastern end of Cuba. No part of either the United States or of Cuba, Guantanamo was one of the known world's last no-man's lands. Bush administration lawyer John Yoo called it the legal equivalent of outer space. On January 9, 2002, Yoo and a colleague submitted to the Department of Defense the first of what came to be called the torture memos, in which they concluded that international treaties, including the Geneva Conventions, do not apply to the Taliban militia, because although Afghanistan had been part of the Geneva Conventions since 1956, it was a failed state. International treaties, the memo maintained, do not protect members of the Al-Qaeda organization, which is a non-state actor cannot be party to the international agreements governing war. 2 days later, the first 20 prisoners, shackled, hooded, and blindfolded, arrived at Guantanamo. More camps were soon built to house more prisoners, eventually 779 from 48 countries. They weren't called criminals, because criminals have to be charged with a crime. They weren't called prisoners, because prisoners of war have rights. They were unlawful combatants who were being detained in what the White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez called a new kind of war, although it was as ancient as torture itself. The White House answered terrorism and abandonment of the law of war with torture and abandonment of the rule of law. Aside from the weight of history, centuries of political philosophy and of international law, and not least its futility as a means for obtaining evidence, another obstacle to torture remained. The Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, a treaty the United States had signed in 1988. This objection was addressed in a 50-page August 2002 memo to Gonzalez that attempted to codify a distinction between acts that are cruel, inhuman, and degrading, and acts that constitute torture. Severe pain, for instance, was defined as pain that caused death, organ failure, or permanent damage resulting in the loss of significant bodily function. If the detainee dies, you're doing it wrong, the chief counsel for the CIA's Counterterrorism Center advised, according to meeting minutes later released by the Senate Armed Service Committee. Methods described in the torture memos included stripping, shackling, exposure to extremes of temperature and light, sexual humiliation, threats to family members, near drowning, and the use of dogs. Many of these forms of torment, including sleep deprivation and semi-starvation, came from a 1957 U.S. Air Force study called Communist Attempts to Elicit False Confessions from Air Force Prisoners of War, an investigation of methods used by the Chinese communists who tortured American prisoners during the Korean War. Top security advisors, including Colin Powell, objected to what the White House called enhanced interrogation techniques. Others, including Ashcroft, urged discretion. "Why are we talking about this at the White House?" he is said to have asked at one meeting, warning, "History will not judge this kindly." But the position of the Secretary of Defense prevailed. On a list of interrogation techniques approved for the use of the U.S. military, Rumsfeld wrote, "I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day. Why is standing limited to 4 hours? DR." Torture wasn't confined to Guantanamo. In Iraq, American forces inflicted torture at Abu Ghraib, and in Afghanistan, in a CIA prison, in Kabul, and at Bagram Air Base, where in 2002, two men died while chained to the ceiling of their cells. Within the Legal Academy and among civil liberties organizations, opposition both to provisions of the Patriot Act and to the treatment of suspected terrorists had been ongoing. During Barack Obama's 2003 Senate bid, he called the Patriot Act a good example of fundamental principles being violated and objected to the lack of due process in the arrest and trials of suspected terrorists. Glimpses of what was happening only reached the American public in 2004 after The New Yorker and 60 Minutes reported on abuses at Abu Ghraib and the ACLU published the torture memos. In June 2006, in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, the Supreme Court ruled that without congressional authority, the president lacked the power to establish the military commissions. 6 months later, Congress authorized the commissions, but in 2008, the court found this act unconstitutional as well. Still, something crucial about the fundamental institutions on which the nation had been founded had been very badly shaken. The Supreme Court's ruling had neither righted the republic nor healed its divisions. During Bush's 2 terms in office, income inequality widened and polarization worsened, as they had during the Clinton years and in the Reagan years, and as they would under Obama and Trump. A Bush-era tax cut granted 45% of its savings to the top 1% of income earners and 13% to the poorest 60%. In 2004 and again in 2008, the percentage of voters who did things like post campaign yard signs in front of their houses or paste bumper stickers onto their cars was higher than it had been at any time since people had been counting those things in 1952. Members of Congress no longer regretted hyperpartisanship, but instead celebrated it, outgoing Republican House Majority Leader Tom DeLay insisting in his 2006 farewell address that the common lament over the recent rise in political partisanship is often nothing more than a veiled complaint instead about the recent rise of political conservatism. DeLay had been indicted for money laundering and had also been tied to all manner of other political grubbiness in connection with the Russian government and with lobbyists. Political insiders like DeLay had a financial stake in heightened partisanship. The more partisan the country, the more money they could raise for re-election, and the more money they could make after they left office. Before the 1990s, change elections, when a new party took over Congress or the White House or both, meant that politicians who were thrown out of office left town, along with their staff. That stopped happening. Instead, politicians stayed in Washington and became pundits, or political consultants, or management consultants, or most likely lobbyists, or, for those with the least scruples, all of the above. They made gargantuan sums of money through speaking fees, or selling their memoirs, or hawking their connections, or appearing on television. The cable stations, compelled to fill 24 hours of airtime, needed talking heads at all hours of every day. The angrier and more adversarial the talk, the higher the ratings. Insiders have always been here, the New York Times' Mark Leibovitz observed in 2013. But they're more of a swarm now, bigger, shinier online, and working it all that much harder. Bush's presidency ended with a global economic collapse, the explosion of a time bomb that had begun ticking during the Reagan administration. Clinton's administration had not managed to defuse that bomb. Instead, it had contributed to the deregulation of the financial services industry by repealing parts of the New Deal's Glass-Steagall Act. Like all financial collapses in the long course of American history, starting with the Panic of 1792, it seemed to come suddenly, but looking back, it appeared inevitable. Wall Street totters from the top. Most of the suffering happens at the bottom. The first to fall were financial services giants, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch, which had been wildly leveraged in high-risk subprime mortgages. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 14,164 in October 2007, had fallen to 8,776 by the end of 2008. Unemployment rose by nearly 5 percentage points. Home values fell by 20%. In the last years of Bush's administration, nearly 900,000 properties were repossessed. Millions of Americans lost their homes. In yards once festooned with campaign placards, Bush-Cheney 04, or Kerry Edwards, A Stronger America, foreclosure and for sale signs waved in front of doors boarded with plywood. Here and there, the tails of yellow ribbons fluttered from trees in remembrance of soldiers. Here and there were staked flags and signs painted red, white, and blue, bring our troops home. And still, in the faraway and troubled lands of Afghanistan and Iraq, the wars dragged on, seen occasionally on Americans' flickering, handheld screens and fleeting footage of ruin and rubble. 2. Barack Obama had a narrow face and big ears and copper-colored skin, and sometimes he spoke like a preacher, and sometimes he spoke like a professor, but he always spoke with a studied equanimity and a determined forbearance. We, the people, have remained faithful to the ideals of our forebears and true to our founding documents, he said in his inaugural address in 2009, speaking to the largest crowd ever recorded in the nation's capital, more than 1.5 million people, on a terribly cold Tuesday in January. The day of hope and change was a day of hats and mittens. His voice rose and fell with the cadences of Martin Luther King Jr., and held fast with the resolve of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. People had drone for hours, for tens of hours, to see him sworn in. I just feel like if he had the opportunity to be there for the Gettysburg Address or when Hank Aaron hit his historic home run, would you take it? Dennis Madsen, a 39-year-old urban planner from Atlanta, told CNN. 8-year-old Bethany Dockery from Memphis wore a pink hat and coat and jumped up and down when Obama took the oath of office. It makes us feel good, her mother said, crying. 'Cause we have a chance. The time had come, Obama said, to choose our better history. For Obama, that better history meant the long struggle against adversity and inequality, the work that generations of Americans had done for prosperity and justice. His inauguration marked a turn in American history. But just around that bend lay a hairpin. He'd wanted to be a writer. He'd written his first book, Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance, when he was 33, long before running for office. His life is an open book, his wife Michelle later said. He wrote it, and you can read it. He'd been reckoning with race and inheritance since he was a little boy. To some extent, he once told a reporter, I'm a symbolic stand-in for a lot of the changes that have been made. But he'd also made himself that stand-in by writing about it. Obama's mother's father, Stanley Dunham, born in Wichita, Kansas in 1918, was named after the explorer Henry Morton Stanley, whose books included In Darkest Africa, which was published right around the time that Obama's father's father, Hussein Obama, was born in Kanyajiang, Kenya. During the Second World War, Hussein Obama worked as a cook for the British Army in Burma, and Stanley Dunham enlisted in the U.S. Army and went to Europe, while in Wichita, his wife Madeline helped build B-29s for Boeing. Obama's father, Barack Hussein Obama, was born in 1936, his mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, in 1942. On September 26, 1960, the day Richard M. Nixon first debated John F. Kennedy, 17-year-old Stanley Ann Dunham met 23-year-old Barack Hussein Obama in an elementary Russian class at the University of Hawaii. By Election Day, she was pregnant. They married on February 2, 1961, 2 weeks after Kennedy's inauguration, in the Wailuku County Courthouse. In 21 states, that marriage would have been illegal as a violation of miscegenation laws that were not overturned by the Supreme Court until 1967 in Loving v. Virginia. Neither family approved of the marriage. As recorded on his birth certificate, Barack Hussein Obama II was born in the Kaipilani Maternity and Gynecological Hospital in Honolulu on August 4, 1961, at 7:24 p.m. As a boy, living with his grandparents in Hawaii, his parents had divorced, young Barack Obama became a reader. He soaked up James Baldwin and W.E.B. Du Bois. "At night, I would close the door to my room," he later wrote, "and there I would sit and wrestle with words, locked in a suddenly desperate argument, trying to reconcile the world as I'd found it with the terms of my birth." After graduating from Columbia, he worked as a community organizer on the south side of Chicago, planting roots in a city that had just elected its first black mayor. He joined a black Baptist church and began dating an ambitious young lawyer named Michelle Robinson, descended from men and women who'd been held in slavery. At Harvard Law School, he worked as a research assistant for Lawrence Tribe, who'd been looking for common ground between what appeared to be incommensurable arguments. This would become Obama's signature move, too, reconciling seemingly irreconcilable differences. Not since Woodrow Wilson had Americans elected a scholar as president. At the University of Chicago Law School, Obama taught a seminar on race and law that amounted to a history of the United States itself, from Andrew Jackson and Indian removal through Reconstruction and Jim Crow, from civil rights to Ronald Reagan and affirmative action. Later, during the campaign, when the course syllabus was posted online, constitutional scholars from both the right and the left applauded its even-handedness. Obama, as a professor, cultivated the values of engaged, open-minded debate. Students were to be graded for their ability to draw out the full spectrum of views, for the display of a thorough examination of the diversity of opinion, and for evidence of having broken some sweat trying to figure out the problem in all of its wonderful complexity. By no means was it clear that what worked in a law school seminar room would work in Washington. In 1996, the professor sought a seat in the state Senate and offered this bridge across the American divide. The right had hijacked the higher moral ground with this language of family values and moral responsibility, and the left had ceded that ground and needed to gain it back because a language of moral responsibility was what the whole nation needed together. "We have to take this same language, these same values that are encouraged within our families, of looking out for one another, of sharing, of sacrificing for each other, and apply them to a larger society," he said. Obama brought together the language of the nation's founding with the language of its religious traditions. Elected to the U.S. Senate, where he became its only black member, he was tapped to deliver the keynote address at the 2004 Democratic National Convention. He wrote a speech that drew as much on the Bible, "I am my brother's keeper," as on the Declaration of Independence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." And he recited both as prayers. Like William Jennings Bryan before him, Obama had worked with a Shakespearean speech coach. Part preacher, part courtroom lawyer, he electrified the crowd. "There are those who are preparing to divide us, the spin masters and negative ad peddlers who embrace the politics of anything goes," he said. "Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is a United States of America." Obama mania began that night. He was young and handsome and glamorous, his rhetoric soared. Reporters especially swooned. Before he'd even taken his seat in the Senate, Obama was asked if he intended to run for president, a question he waved away. He did not enjoy his time in the Senate. If after the end of his term he stayed in Washington, he told a friend, shoot me. He found bloody-minded partisanship maddening. Liberals were fools if they thought they could defeat conservatives by treating them like enemies. The American people, he insisted, don't think George Bush is mean-spirited or prejudiced. Instead, he went on, they are angry that the case to invade Iraq was exaggerated, are worried that we have unnecessarily alienated existing and potential allies around the world, and are ashamed by events like those at Abu Ghraib, which violate our ideals as a country. Obama ran for the Democratic nomination in 2008 with a slogan adapted from the 1972 United Farm Workers campaign of Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. Si se puede. Yes, we can. His resume for the job was thin. He ran on his talent, his character, and his story. Some people said he was too black. Some people said he wasn't black enough. In a heated and very close primary race against 60-year-old Hillary Clinton, he benefited from having opposed the Iraq War, which Clinton, then in the Senate, had voted to authorize. And while Clinton began with deep support from African-American voters and leaders, that support was squandered by her husband. Threatened by Obama's poise and charm, a cooler, blacker, and more upright version of himself, Bill Clinton alienated black voters by accusing Obama and his supporters of deviousness. I think they played the race card on me, the former president complained. In an age of extremes, Obama projected reasonableness and equanimity in politics and candor about religion. His faith, he said, admits doubt and uncertainty and mystery. His belief in the United States, a faith in simple dreams and insistence on small miracles, admitted no doubt. In a time of war and of economic decline, he projected the optimism of Reagan and held the political commitments, it appeared, of FDR. Obama's candidacy stirred an apathetic electorate. It also changed the nature of campaigning. Turnout in 2008 was the highest since 1968. Against the much-admired long-term Republican senator from Arizona, John McCain, who'd been a prisoner of war in Vietnam, Obama won by more than 9 million votes. He also defeated McCain on social media. McCain, 72, a man of his generation, hadn't yet grasped the power of new forms of political communication. Obama's campaign had four times as many followers as McCain on Facebook, the social media juggernaut, and an astounding 23 times as many on Twitter. His digital team registered voters at a website called Vote for Change. His supporters, who texted HOPE to join his list, received three texts on Election Day alone. When he won, more than a million Americans received a text that read, "All of this happened because of you. Thanks, Barack." Obama had promised hope and change. He seemed at first poised to deliver both. He swept into office with majorities in both the House and the Senate, and the wind of history at his back. It proved a fickle wind. To address the global financial collapse that had torqued the markets during Bush's last months in office, he asked Congress to approve a stimulus program of $800 billion that reporters dubbed the New New Deal. The Economist announced Roosevelt Mania. But Obama was no FDR. His administration did not prosecute the people whose wrongdoing had led to the financial disaster. His economic program rescued the banks, but it didn't rescue people who'd lost their savings. During Obama's first year in office, while ordinary Americans lost their jobs, their houses, and their retirement money, executives at Wall Street's 38 largest companies earned $140 billion, and the nation's top 25 hedge fund managers earned an average of $464 million. Obama's biggest initiative was the Affordable Health Care Act, which passed the Senate at the end of 2009 and the House at the beginning of 2010 in a razor-thin party-line vote, 219 to 212. It had been a century since American progressives first proposed national health care. Hillary Clinton's own proposal had failed badly in 1994. Obama, inspired by a biography of Lincoln, who put his political rivals in his cabinet, had named Clinton as a Secretary of State. But the win was diminished by the fury of the campaign to repeal it, a campaign begun even before the legislation passed. The day before Obama's inauguration, Fox News launched a new program hosted by a radio talk show celebrity named Glenn Beck. Beck compared Obama to Mussolini. He turned his television studio into an old-fashioned one-room schoolhouse with chalk and a blackboard and oak desks and lectured his viewers about American history and how everything Obama stood for was a betrayal of the Founding Fathers. If Beck's campaign was different from Alex Jones and the Truthers, It drew on the same animus and exploited the same history of racial hatred. In March, Beck launched a movement called 9/12, whose purpose was to restore the unity Americans had supposedly felt the day after the attacks on the Twin Towers. Opponents of Obama's economic plan and of health care reform called for a new Tea Party to resist the tyranny of the federal government. In the spring of 2009, Tea Partiers across the country held rallies on town commons and city streets, waving copies of the Constitution. They dressed up as George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin, in tri-cornered hats and powdered wigs, knee breeches, and buttoned waistcoats. They believed American history was on their side. They wanted, in words that would later become Donald Trump's slogan, to make America great again. With the Tea Party, the conservative media and the conservative movement merged. The Tea Party was in some ways a political product manufactured by Fox News. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, who'd gained a place in the national spotlight when McCain named her as his running mate in 2008, signed a $1 million per year contract with Fox and then began speaking at Tea Party rallies. Glenn Beck began holding Founders Fridays. Fox News host Sean Hannity began invoking the Liberty Tree. But the Tea Party was much more than a product of Fox News. It was also an earnest grassroots movement. Some Tea Partiers cherished the NRA's interpretation of the Second Amendment, or cared deeply about prayer in schools, or were opposed to same-sex marriage. Some held grievances against globalization, about immigration and trade deals, echoes of the fears from the isolationist and nativist 1920s. Most had plenty of long-standing populist grievances about taxes in particular, and their objections to a federally funded health care program, like the plans for such a program, dated back more than a century. In the 21st century, the Tea Party married 19th century populism to 20th century originalism. As populists, they blamed a conspiracy of federal government policymakers and Wall Street fat cats for their suffering. As originalists, they sought a remedy for what ailed them and a return to the original meaning of the Constitution. Not irrelevantly, the movement was overwhelmingly white, and it imagined a history that was overwhelmingly white, too. This is not to say that Tea Partiers were racists, though many liberals did say this, often without the least foundation, but instead that the story of American history had been impoverished by not being told either fully or well. Whole parts, too, had been rejected. The American soil is full of the corpses of my ancestors through 400 years and at least three wars, James Baldwin had written in 1965, wrote Baldwin. What one begs the American people to do for all our sakes is simply to accept our history. That acceptance had not come. If most Tea Partiers were mainly worried about their taxes, a few really did object to the changing nature of the Republic, on the ground that it was becoming less white. They objected to the very idea of a black president. It was as if they had resurrected Roger Taney's argument from Dred Scott in 1857, when he ruled that no person of African descent could ever become an American citizen. Impeach Obama, their signs read. He's unconstitutional. In December 2010, 69-year-old Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders delivered an 8.5-hour speech on the floor of the Senate, without eating or drinking or sitting down or taking a bathroom break. He had no audience but the cameras. Sanders wasn't speaking to his fellow senators. He was trying to reach the public directly through social media. "My speech was the most Twittered event in the world on that day," Sanders later said. Sanders, born in Brooklyn in 1941, had been a civil rights and anti-war activist at the University of Chicago, leading sit-ins against segregated housing on campus and working for SNCC. After Chicago, he moved to Vermont, where he ran for mayor of Burlington. He took office the same year Reagan was inaugurated. 10 years later, he went to Washington as Vermont's only member of Congress. "There were perks to being the only socialist in Congress," he told the New York Times. "I can't get punished," he said. "What are they going to do, kick me out of the party?" Sanders' career in the Senate began in 2007. Obama had campaigned for him in 2006 and had been undistinguished. But during the recession, he emerged as one of the few prominent people in Washington, a city flooded with money, willing to speak about poverty. The numbers were staggering. In 1928, the top 1% of American families earned 24% of all income. In 1944, they earned 11%, a rate that remained flat for several decades but began to rise in the 1970s. By 2011, the top 1% of American families was once again earning 24% of the nation's income. In 2013, the U.S. Census Bureau reported a Gini Index of 0.476, the highest ever recorded in any affluent democracy. Nations with income inequality similar to that in the United States at the time included Uganda at 0.447 and China at 0.474. Sanders was a socialist. His hero was Eugene Debs. He'd once made a recording of Debs delivering his most famous speech during the First World War. "I am opposed to every war but one," Debs had said then. "I am for that war with heart and soul, and that is the worldwide war of the social revolution. In that war, I am prepared to fight any way the revolution the ruling class may make necessary, even to the barricades." Sanders, nearly a century later, offered his echo, as if history were a reel of tape, winding and rewinding and winding again. "There is a war going on in this country," Sanders said. "I am not referring to the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan. I am talking about a war being waged by some of the wealthiest and most powerful people against working families, against the disappearing and shrinking middle class of our country." In 2010, in a series of deals that made possible the passage of health care reform, Democrats agreed to extend the Bush-era tax cuts, and Sanders was one of the few members of Congress to object. "President Obama has said that he fought as hard as he could against the Republican tax breaks for the wealthy and for an extension in unemployment," he said during his 8-hour speech. "Well, maybe. But the reality is, that fight cannot simply be waged inside the Beltway. Our job is to appeal to the vast majority of the American people and to stand up and say, wait a minute!" By 2011, Sanders was no longer a lone voice in the wilderness. Protests against the bailout and against tuition hikes and budget cuts had started at the University of California in 2009, where students occupying a campus building carried signs that read, "Occupy everything. Demand nothing." The Occupy movement spread on social media, adopting the slogan, "We are the 99%. Occupy Wall Street, an encampment in Zuccotti Park in downtown New York, begun in September 2011, drew thousands. Within months, Occupy protests had been staged in more than 600 American communities and in hundreds more cities around the world. "We desperately need a coming together of working people to stand up to Wall Street, corporate America, and say, enough is enough," Sanders said during Occupy Wall Street. "We need to rebuild the middle class in this country." Occupy, for all its rhetoric, was not a coming together of a representative array of working people. It was overwhelmingly and notably urban and white, and most protesters were students or people with jobs. It also had no real leadership, favoring a model of direct democracy, and lacked particular achievable policy goals, preferring loftier objectives, like reinventing politics. Demand nothing. But it did propel Sanders to national prominence and establish the foundations for a movement that would lead him to one of the most remarkable progressive presidential campaigns since Theodore Roosevelt in 1912. If the Tea Party married populism to originalism, Occupy married populism to socialism. The Tea Party on the right and Occupy on the left together offered an assault on Washington, sharing the conviction that the federal government had grown indifferent to the lives of ordinary Americans. Neither Republicans nor Democrats were able to unseat that conviction. Obama's team had gone to Washington disdainful of insider Washington, with its moneymakers and its dealmakers and its partisanship for hire. This piety did not last. David Plouffe, Obama's 2008 campaign manager, called the GOP a party led by people who foment anger and controversy to make a name for themselves and to make a buck. In 2010, Plouffe earned $1.5 million. His income included management consulting, work for Boeing and GE, and speaking gigs booked through the Washington Speakers Bureau. Nor did the press on the whole hold politicians to account. Reporters had become embedded journalists in Iraq. More were embedded in Washington. So breezily did the press socialize with White House and congressional staff that a politician's wife issuing an invitation to a child's birthday party might take pains to announce that it would be off the record. But in truth, hardly anything was off the record, and the record was blaring. The race car pace of online news, the daily email newsletters, blogs, and then Twitter made for frantic, absurd fixations and postures, both grand and petty. "Never before has the so-called permanent establishment of Washington included so many people in the media," reported Mark Leibovich. "They are, by and large, a cohort that is predominantly white and male. They held iPhones in their hands and wore wireless receivers in their ears. They reported in breathless bursts. They are aggressive, technology-savvy, and preoccupied by quick bottom lines," wrote Leibovich. "Who's winning? Who's losing? Who gaffed?" The mantras of Obama's University of Chicago Law School syllabus were not the watchwords of jacked-up, Bluetooth, wallet-stuffed Washington. "Draw out the full spectrum of views on the issues you're dealing with," he'd instructed his students. "Display a thorough examination of the diversity of opinion that exists on the issue or theme." House members raising money for re-election and booking their next television appearance didn't think that way. Obama's administration, unsurprisingly, found it difficult to gain traction with Congress, and the new president's commitment to calm, reasoned deliberation proved untenable in a madcap capital. The president's aloofness kept him from the fray. Then, too, his signature health care act was a complicated piece of legislation, a feast for people who could make money by mocking it or by explaining it or both. Sarah Palin said that Obama's health care plan would lead to death panels, which, while both absurd and untrue, was simply put. This, and the Democratic response, was the sort of outrageous assertion that generated a lot of web traffic, which had become a kind of virtual currency. Madness meant money. "We get paid to get Republicans pissed off at Democrats, which they rightfully are," one Republican lobbyist told the Huffington Post. "It's the easiest thing in the world. It's like getting paid to get you to love your mother." The intricacies of reforming health care insurance, which constituted a fifth of the American economy, chiefly served the interests of lobbyists. "Complication and uncertainty is good for us," said Democratic lobbyist Tony Podesta, the brother of Bill Clinton's former chief of staff, John Podesta. "It meant more clients." More money was made by more people interested in profiting from political decay after the Supreme Court ruled in a 2010 case called Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission that restrictions on spending by political action committees and other groups were unconstitutional. Roscoe Conkling's fateful maneuver of 1882, telling the Supreme Court that when he'd helped draft the 14th Amendment, the committee had changed the word citizens to persons in order to protect the rights of corporations, would make judicial history time and time again. Where earlier rulings had granted corporations as persons certain liberties, especially the Lochner-era liberty of contract, Citizens United granted corporations a First Amendment right to free speech. By 2014, the court would grant corporations First Amendment rights to freedom of religious expression. In a landmark case, corporations owned by people who objected to contraception on religious grounds were allowed to refuse to provide insurance coverage for birth control to their employees, citing their corporation's First Amendment rights. And yet on college and university campuses, students continued to protest not for, but against free speech. Every hate speech code that had been instituted since the 1990s that had been challenged in court had been found unconstitutional. Some had been lifted, others disavowed. In 2014, the University of Chicago issued a report on freedom of expression. "The university's fundamental commitment is to the principle that debate or deliberation may not be suppressed because the ideas put forth are thought by some or even most members of the university community to be offensive, unwise, immoral, or wrongheaded." Nevertheless, a generation of younger Americans who had been raised with hate speech codes rejected debate itself. They attempted to silence visiting speakers, including not only half-mad provocateurs, but scholars and serious if controversial public figures, from Condoleezza Rice to longtime political columnist George Will to former FBI Director James Comey. While campus protesters squashed the free speech rights of people, the Supreme Court protected the free speech rights of corporations. When Citizens United demolished the constitutional dam, money flooded the vast plains of American politics from east to west. The Tea Party movement was soon overwhelmed by political grifters. Within 5 years of the movement's founding, its leading organizations, including the Tea Party Express and the Tea Party Patriots, were spending less than 5% of their funds on campaigns and elections. All that money bought nothing so much as yet more rage. Liberal columnist E.J. Dionne detected a pattern. Candidates and parties made big promises, and when they gained power and failed to make good on those promises, they blamed some kind of conspiracy. Any sort of conspiracy. A conspiracy of the press, a conspiracy of the rich, a conspiracy of the deep state, including during Trump's first term, a conspiracy of the FBI. Then they found media organizations willing to present readers with evidence of such a conspiracy, however concocted. Conservative commentator David Frum offered a not dissimilar diagnosis. The media culture of the U.S. has been reshaped to become as a bespoke purveyor of desired facts. Under these circumstances, it was difficult for either party to hold a majority for long. Democrats lost the House in 2010, the Senate in 2014, and the White House in 2016. When Donald Trump was out of the White House, he railed at the government. When he was in the White House, he railed at the press. He railed at Congress. He railed at immigrants. He railed at North Korea. He railed at his staff. He grew red in the face with railing. Well known in the world of professional wrestling, Trump brought to politics the tactics of the arena, which borrowed its conventions of melodrama from reality television, another genre with which Trump was well acquainted, having starred beginning in 2004 and